Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, May 8th, 2025, we're delighted to host a Courthouse Steps decision program on Feliciano versus the Department of Transportation, which was decided recently by the court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guests today brief, certainly more brief than their careers would deserve. So I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we're fortunate to have with us Dr. Gregory Dolan, who's an associate professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, where his scholarship centers on patent law with a focus on how our patent regime affects innovation, especially in biopharmaceutical areas. Dr. Dolan also works as a senior litigation counsel at the New Civil Liberties Alliance and sits on the board of directors of the Jewish Coalition for Religious Liberty. From January 2020 to January 2022, Professor Dolan served as a resident associate justice of the Supreme Court of the Republic of Palau. In this role, he worked together with other members of the court to hear appeals in civil, criminal, administrative, and constitutional law matters. Also joining us today as our moderator for today's conversation is Craig Lean, who is a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of K&L Gates, where he's a member of the Labor, Employment, and Workplace Safety Practice Group. Mr. Lean was formerly the director of the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs, OFCCP, at the U.S. Department of Labor, where he reported directly to the Secretary and Deputy Secretary of Labor. Mr. Lean serves as a professor of government lawyering and a professorial lecturer in law at the George Washington University Law School, as vice chair of the District of Columbia Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and as chair of the Civil and Human Rights Committee of the Bar Association of the District of Columbia. And I will leave it there. A last note throughout the program, if you have any questions, please do submit them via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Lean, the floor is yours.
It's wonderful to be here today with Professor Dolan to talk about a really interesting case that had a very interesting split between the justices, not one that you typically see, Feliciano v. Department of Transportation. And, you know, what's interesting about the case is that you might not think at first glance that this would be a case that will get to the Supreme Court and cause a division like this. And yet, it's a case that actually may have very significant financial impacts for the federal government. And of course, for those individuals who serve in the federal government, who are called up to military service or who volunteer to go to military service while they're in the federal government, it can make a big impact on their lives as well. So the split in this particular case was the majority opinion written by Justice Gorsuch, joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Sotomayor, Kavanaugh and Barrett, and notice Justice Sotomayor in there with the other conservatives. And of course, on the other side, in dissent was Justice Thomas with Justices Alito, Kagan, and Jackson. And you don't often see that split between Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson. So it's a very interesting case, and it essentially involves the differential pay that you would get. So let's say you're I used to be a federal agency head. I did a lot of work with veterans and VEVRA when I was at OFCCP. And, you know, we might have a lot of veterans work in the federal workforce. A lot of people who are reservists work in the federal workforce. And so they may get called up, and their job in the federal government, their usual job, may get paid salary X. And when they go and serve in the military, that new salary may be less. And so the difference in salary, that's the differential, they may be entitled to that if the differential pay statute says they are. And this particular individual, Nick Feliciano, was serving in the military for 5 years. So he had been an air traffic controller, and then he was serving in the Coast Guard as a reserve petty officer, which has a materially lower salary. So obviously wanted that differential pay. So that sort of gives you the facts of the case. At the appellate level, the court had found that there needed to be a substantial relationship when you're called up to your military service, there had to be substantial relationship with an emergency, whereas the majority decision in this case, and which reversed the appellate decision, the lower court decision, the majority indicated that it just has to be temporal. So if you're called up when there's a national emergency of some sort, and Professor Dolan will explain this in more detail, but you would be entitled to that differential pay. Practically, it means almost anyone who's called up, because there's almost always a national emergency somewhere, will get the differential pay. If the minority view had won the day, then you would only get differential pay if you were called up to serve, essentially, in support of that particular national emergency. So with that, I want to turn it over to Professor Dolan. Professor Dolan, can you talk a little bit about this case? Why do you think it's worthy of a courthouse steps decision? And what are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Craig. Thank you very much, Kayla, and the Federal Society for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to be here. And to share my thoughts. And I think I agree that this is not necessarily a case that, you know, everybody is sitting on pins and needles waiting for. You know, people are waiting for Scrimeti, which has to do with transgender issues. People are going to be waiting in the next month or so for upcoming argument and upcoming decision in the citizenship, birthright citizenship cases. People are going to be waiting for a variety of other these big high profile decisions that will be on our front page of New York Times. This is not even back page of New York Times. This is one of those boring cases where it's just about the law. It's not about any sort of public policy. It's how do you parse the statute in a very kind of lawyerly fashion, which I think is actually why it should be on the front page of New York Times, because the public does tend to think that all Supreme Court ever does is abortion and death penalty and gay rights issues and, you know, President Trump's executive orders and, you know, President Biden's loan forgiveness and all that stuff. But really what Supreme Court does much more often than not is the, you know, quote unquote, boring cases where they just do real law. And this case is just great for that. And so it's just a great educational case. It's a great case to see how judges actually work. And to the point that the lineup is unusual, this also goes to show these are not just partisans in robes who kind of, you know, one group likes veterans and the other one likes or doesn't like veterans or likes more fiscal rectitude or whatever else. That's not what they do. These justices actually do real law. They really delve into it and they work with the statute. And so that's why I think it's worthy of a teleform. I think it's worthy of courthouse steps, just to show that judges, for all the things we see in the news, for all the things that are kind of clickbait material, more often than not, judges engage in kind of this real lawyerly work. So with that, let me dive into the case a bit. And Craig has been very helpful to set up kind of the issue is, and the issue is, what does the word during mean in the statute? So the basic, and I'm going to paraphrase a little bit just to make it sort of accessible. And I know that most people on this call are also lawyers. And so maybe I don't need to do much paraphrasing, but nevertheless, I put on my professor hat and sort of teach it and talk about how the way I teach my students. So the statute basically says that if you are called up for from your reserve duty to active service during a national emergency, there's also some other criteria which are not relevant to this discussion directly. During a national emergency, you get the differential pay, which the idea is you don't lose any money while offering your services to the country. And the question is, does during mean at the same time as an emergency is ongoing, meaning it has merely a temporal component to it? Or it does it mean, as the Federal Circuit has held, that it must have a temporal component? So obviously it has to be at the time that there is a national emergency, but your service has to also relate to the national emergency. So for example, if there is a, you know, President Trump, for example, has declared there's an emergency at the southern border. So if you're called up to go and guard the southern border, right, then you are during, because you're both at the same time and you're doing something with respect to that emergency. So the Federal Circuit took the second view that in order to claim the differential pay, you must be called up both at the time emergency is ongoing, but also you have to do something in support of that emergency. And the Federal Circuit actually had three cases on this. So Feliciana was very much a case where a panel of the Federal Circuit said, look, we're bound by prior panels. Although I think in all three of these cases, the same judge wrote the opinion. So although, of course, the rule is that one panel is bound by another. In this case, it's not surprising that the opinion was exactly the same because the same judge wrote all three opinions. In all three opinions, the Federal Circuit said that you have to be both time linked as well as kind of status linked. And the Supreme Court granted cert to resolve the statutory construction question. And what's interesting about this is that you have real textualists on both sides. Now, of course, as Justice Kagan once said, we're all textualists now, and we're all originalists now. So, Justice Gorsuch and Justice Thomas are committed originalists. They're not faint-hearted originalists, as, for example, Justice Kagan might at least sometimes be. And so there's a real debate as to what the word during means. And Justice Gorsuch comes down in, I think, the most straightforward application of this word, says during means at the same time of. He begins with the dictionary definition. He cites one dictionary, but he has drops a footnote saying, if you don't believe me, look at any other dictionary that you like. They all say during means a time component. They also look at how the court has previously interpreted the word during. So, for example, just a few terms ago, there was a case, not at all related to this statute, but there was a case, a criminal law case, where there was an enhanced penalty for somebody who carries a firearm during the commission of a felony. And there was also a very similar argument that that in order to, the convicted person was arguing that in order to be subject to an enhanced penalty, he must not merely carry it during the commission while some other felony is being committed, but he must actually use it. There must be some connection between the gun and the felony. And the court in that case said, no, during means just, temporal relation. And in that case is known as Ressam, decided in, I think, October term 2007. And the court said there's no reason to treat this any differently. The court also kind of having done the just pure textual analysis, Justice Gorsuch does delve into alternative theories as to why, his analysis is correct in the meantime, rejecting government's process. So, for example, Justice Gorsuch said what also supports the straightforward durational linkage only is, for example, you look at how the Congressional Budget Office scored this bill, right? So Congressional Budget, whenever a bill comes up that has any sort of effect on federal budget, the Congressional Budget Office gives it a score, basically tells Congress, look, if you pass this bill, be prepared to spend X dollars for this over the course of Y years. And Justice Gorsuch said when CBO was scoring this bill, not that CBO's interpretation is authoritative, but CBO provides information to Congress, and on basis of that information, Congress votes. And so when CBO provided a score to this bill, they did not say, look, well, some people will be called up to serve on the front lines and some people will be doing some things in the back. And so we're only going to score it kind of halfway, only the money that's going to go to the frontline people. They scored it based on who how many people will be called up during an ongoing emergency, and all of them would get differential pay. And this is the information Congress was given. This is on the basis of this information, Congress approved this bill. Justice Gorsuch also delves into
Professor Dolan, yeah. before you move on from that, one big discussion that often takes place among the justices, originalists versus non-originalists, is whether you can look at legislative history, legislative intent. Have you ever seen CBO score used before? And what do you think about that? That's very interesting.
I have not. And so that does seem odd. But again, we have to remember that Justice Gorsuch is not Justice Scalia, right? Justice Scalia was famous for saying, well, I join everything but footnote 7 that talks about legislative history. Justice Gorsuch is not that. But also, I think it's not really legislative history. He is not using CBO as saying, look, this is something authoritative. He's using it more of a kind of information on which Congress has relied, right? It's not, he doesn't say that we use CBO to interpret the language. He said Congress used CBO to interpret the language, right? So Congress had particular information and they voted for it. And if they thought this would have been too expensive, that we only should be paying just the people who are serving on the front line, perhaps there'll be some debate, there'll be some mention of it, some amendments offered to say like, look, we can't spend that much money, right? So, but you're right. I've never seen CBO relied on before. And so it's an interesting thing, but I don't really think it's necessarily a backsliding into legislative history. Justice Gorsuch also addresses kind of the purpose of this point. One of the arguments the government presents is saying that, look, we want to pay people at least their equivalent salary if we're sending them to the front line, because otherwise who would volunteer to do that? But, you know, people who are, working in the office, but maybe basically still going home, you know, if you're, say, an air traffic controller at DCA airport, but now you've activated and all you're doing is just driving instead of to DCA, you're driving to the Pentagon, doing some paperwork. There's no necessarily reason to do that. And Justice Gorsuch, I think correctly, in my view, says, not to be too crude about it, but said, like, look, in some sense, obviously all of us are individuals and all of us have our unique qualities and et cetera. But in some sort of sense, people are fungible, and only in a sense, again, not because we're all just a mass, but in a sense that if you have a person A doing office work, that frees up person B to be on the front line, right? So you need both. And it makes our armed forces stronger when you can activate reservists no matter where you put them, whether you put them on a front line, somewhere in the supply chain, or in the back office. And so on the purpose of this point, says that if the whole point of this activating reservists is to make them stronger, or to make the armed forces stronger, then it shouldn't matter where the Army chooses to assign. And then finally, kind of on an administrative point, he says, if we were to adopt the Federal Circuit approach and the government's approach, the courts are going to be really stuck with trying to figure out not only is there a relation between service and an emergency, but is there a sufficient relation? And what also happens when, you know, first you're assigned to the front line and then you're sort of rotated out without necessarily going home? What if you're in service of two separate emergency ongoing? And it's going to be just very difficult to actually administer the system. And so taking all of those ideas together, Justice Gorsuch says the most logical way, the most clear way to interpret the word during is just durational component. Now, of course, Justice Thomas dissents, but he goes through the exact same analysis. He says that, look, we can look at dictionaries, and during sometimes means durational component, but sometimes also means during and in relation to. He says, for example, if you have a phrase, attorney making an argument during a court hearing, obviously cannot possibly mean that just because some judge somewhere in the world is having a hearing, an attorney is arguing in front of a mirror in his own bathroom, he is making an argument during a court hearing. It must be in relation to that hearing. And so there's no reason to treat this any different. Justice Thomas also goes through the purpose of his point. He says that the reason we want to give differential pay to people who are at the front line is because you want to entice them to do that. But perhaps people who are working at back office don't need to do that. Justice Thomas also discusses, discusses prior cases where the court has, says, yes, we've held in Ressam that holding a firearm during, during a commission of a felony is just durational. But in other cases, we've interpreted the word differently. And ultimately, I think Justice Thomas, although I think he's doing mostly textualism, I think somewhat uncharacteristically for him, he delves a bit more into kind of the effect and the purpose of interpreting the question presented differently. And I think he talks about, he relies more on how this would play out if you start paying everyone the differential component. But nevertheless, unlike some other opinions, the majority and dissent don't talk past each other. They really are engaged with each other. So for all of the examples, for this example of Justice Thomas citing that attorney talking during a hearing, it must actually mean not just, one attorney talking on one side of the country and a hearing happening on the other side of the country entirely without relation. It has some sort of relation to the Justice Gorsuch actually responds to it. One other very interesting thing about Justice Thomas's dissent is kind of, so the real world story. Justice Thomas says, and I have on my screen open a Wikipedia page, how many ongoing emergencies are in effect right now. So for those people who may want to know, there are currently, as I am making this statement, there are 41 national emergencies ongoing. Indeed, since about 1917 or so, there has not been a time, with a one-year exception in 1978, where it has not been at least one emergency. Some emergencies have lasted since 1979. So, for example, one of the emergencies that President Carter declared as a result of the Iranian Revolution and the takeover of our embassy, it is still ongoing as of today. Some emergencies are, you know, newer. So some of them declared by President Trump on January 20th. And so Justice Thomas was saying that, look, if during means during any national emergency, then you don't really need the rest of the statute because you will always have a national emergency just based on our history. And majority responds that just because Congress doesn't seem to have the fortitude to rein in presidential use of these emergency powers doesn't actually mean that we have to, as judge, have to assume that there will always be an emergency. In fact, that 1 year gap when there we had no emergency, the 78 to 79, that's when Congress passed the Emergency Act, canceling all existing emergency and giving president new guidelines as to how to declare them. And of course, president immediately started using them. But Justice Gorsuch simply says, we can't assume what tomorrow will be like. We can only assume the background against which Congress legislated and as it exists today. Where Justice Thomas, I think, and again, somewhat uncharacteristically, takes a much more realist approach. He's saying, come on, guys, there will always be an emergency. Presidents love this thing because it lets them do certain things they will not be able to do otherwise. And so because there will be always an emergency ongoing, in order to make sense of the rest of the provisions of the statute, there must be not only a time, you know, a durational component, but also a relational component. So the bottom line, I think, and I'll stop here, is that this is a, you know, quote unquote, boring case. It's just statutory construction. It affects a very specific segment of the population. But it is an amazing, amazing case to teach statutory interpretation to students, to or to the public, to see how, number one, how textualism is not merely picking the sites that you like. Textualism, when two people are engaged in true textualism, can lead to different outcomes, that it is not necessarily politically, textualism doesn't necessarily have political valence. You can have somebody like Justice Thomas and Justice Jackson, who are on the opposite poles of the court, come out to the same answer, while Justice Sotomayor, who kind of is close to Justice Jackson, come out to a different answer. So I think it's a very worthwhile opinion to read to see how meticulous judges go through it and how they're really engaged in a real law work.
Thank you, Professor Dolan. So let me ask you this question. It's interesting that in Nick Feliciano's orders, that it said that he was being called up in support of several contingency operations, including Operations Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom. Did the court really need to reach this issue? Couldn't they have looked just at the orders and said, look, the government itself called you up in support of national emergencies and then not reach the question?
I think it had to, because I think the Federal Circuit took that also at face value. But the test from the Federal Circuit was that it's not merely in support of, but you have to be kind of supporting it directly. So, and I think that was kind of Justice Gorsuch's point in some sense as well. He was saying, look, whatever work you do, again, whether in the office, whether you may be now a military air traffic controller, but from far away, maybe you're training other people, whatever that you're doing, by doing X, you're freeing somebody else that would otherwise have to be doing that X. And so that all is in support. And so that's good enough. But that's not the test the Federal Circuit applied. And so even though the Federal Circuit obviously had the same paperwork in front of it. And so I think the court did need to reach this question to if they were going to clarify or overrule the Federal Circuit's test.
And how about this? So one thing that's interesting about the definition and the idea of what does during mean is that term comes up in it's sort of a reference in the statute to the term contingency operation. And then the actual definition says, during a war or during a national emergency declared by the president or Congress. And obviously, you know, during a war, there's a prescribed way to declare war. But national emergency declared by the president, as you've mentioned, is always, apparently, since the early 20th century. So how does a court approach, as a textualist, obviously they differed here. How would you have approached it?
Oh, I don't want to second guess justices. That's an unfair question. But, you know, I tend to, if you gone to my head, I tend to agree with the majority opinion. I think they got it right. It's a very close case. Obviously, like, again, the court split 5-4 on this. So I think I can't go wrong by saying I would have been one camp or another. But I think what really convinced me are the two points in a majority. One is that, again, it's kind of this, and I've said it before, but so I'll say it again. It's kind of when one is called up to essentially help out, you know, again, look, we've learned when we were kids, when your parents said, like, look, can you help me, like, do the dishes, that frees your parents to do something else, right? To sweep the floor, right? And so you are in support of cleaning the house. Even though you may not necessarily be the one cleaning the house, you may be just doing the dishes or maybe making your bed or whatever else. So I think that point convinced me, as well as the administrative point, kind of having the courts try to figure out on the back end, how closely were you related to whatever it is, you know, to the actual emergency, especially when people can get assigned and reassigned throughout. And somebody like Nick Feliciano was doing, what, 5 years in the Army? So I imagine he was not necessarily, maybe he was doing the same thing over and over again, but people who were doing that sort of term sometimes can be on a front line, sometimes they can be in the back, sometimes they can be on vacation, sometimes they can be doing all sorts of things. And having to keep track, like us lawyers do, in 6-minute increments to try to figure out, are you really in support at that particular moment? And for that particular moment, did you get back pay? And then for others, you don't, seems to be, to me, to be more trouble than it's worth, and probably not the way Congress intended the agencies that have to provide the differential pay to spend their time to try to really figure this out. So I think that's kind of what put the thumbs on a scale for me. But I admit this is not an easy statutory construction case.
Well, you know, it reminded me, and we talked about this when we were preparing, but when I was at OFCCP, one of the statutes we enforced was the Vietnam Era Veterans Readjustment Assistance Act, VEVRA, which is a veteran civil rights statute that applies and it basically protects against discrimination and also helps veterans get hired after they leave the military. And part of that is the definition of what veterans it applies to, and it's called protected veterans. And a protected veteran is anyone that serves during, it's very similar, it doesn't use the exact same terminology, but basically during a war, a declared war or national emergency. And it, and practically applies to every protected veteran going back into the 70s, you know, so, and that's the way it's been applied. And it reminded me of that. It seems like here that Congress, particularly with the CBO score point, might be open here to paying those who go into the military from federal service, that additional pay. That made sense to me. But the thing that resonated throughout with this case was it was all based on these practical considerations, because in the end, it did seem to be a truly ambiguous situation, which could go either way. I think when we were talking, you said that you would view this more as a liberal decision, probably if it were scored. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so a liberal decision only in a sense that, there are some political scientists who, as when they try to figure out is a court as a whole liberal or conservative, they take every decision and they assign a score like 0 points for liberal, 1 point for conservative decision. And sometimes it's somewhat arbitrary, right? Is a particular decision liberal or conservative? Now, some of them are, quote unquote, easy. For example, a decision that limits the application of death penalty, given the political party's positions on that, that probably be scored as liberal. The one that expands it would be scored as conservative. But this one, I don't know whether it's liberal or conservative. I think it would probably be scored as a liberal decision because it is more pro-veteran. It's less receptive to government's argument about conserving governmental fisc. So I think it's liberal in that sense, but I don't really think it, you know, I like if you kind of went and polled a bunch of Republicans and a bunch of Democrats, I think you would get fairly uniform results saying, yes, we love our veterans. They should get as much money as Congress appropriated. And like, nobody's going to say, you know what, forget it. Like, veterans don't deserve anything, right? We, at least post Vietnam, we generally think veterans ought to be given as much as we can give them. What I actually did find interesting is that in nowhere here did the court rely on the so-called pro-veteran canon. Now, that usually is a canon that applied when the facts are close, but it's something that Justice Gorsuch criticized previously. He said, like, look, it's one thing for Congress to be pro-veteran because it balances, it's kind of like, look, we can spend money on veterans or we can spend money on, you know, building roads or, you know, opening up more embassies or whatever, right? And so they can say, look, this is more important and this is less important. But the courts have to just take congressional handiwork as they find it. And there's no reason to make these sort of policy judgments. So in one of his concurrences, he kind of, he said, like, I don't know where this pro-veteran canon comes from. And so neither majority nor dissent kind of said, like, look, we got to put our thumb on a scale for the veterans. Yeah, so I think, like, while this opinion could be scored as quote-unquote liberal in the political science sense, I don't think it's liberal in a political Republican-Democratic sense. I don't think it's liberal in a judicial methodology sense. I don't think the court is saying, look, we're just going to do what, you know, we're not going to look at text. We're just going to look at legislative history, or we're going to look at pure policy considerations. So in that sense, I think that's very conservative opinion, but that's what I find interesting. It's that conservative methodology, if done right, can lead to conservative outcomes. It can lead to liberal outcomes. It can lead to middle of the road outcomes. Methodology of like conservative adherence to the text does not in and of itself have political valence. It simply says Congress did what it did. Maybe they did a good job, maybe they did a bad job, maybe they did a sloppy job, maybe they did a very careful job. But we're not Congress, we're not judges, we're not a court of revisers. We are just interpreting what Congress did the best we can. And sometimes that will give us, you know, results Democrats like, sometimes it will give results Republicans like, sometimes it will give results that nobody likes or that everybody likes. But if you don't like it, what we do, you all you have to do is go across the street to Congress and lobby them to change it.
You know, what's interesting here is I agree with you. I think this is a result that probably both Republicans and Democrats would like. And yet you did have the Federal Circuit going the other way and four justices going the other way, which in some ways, I think you're right. To me, it shows that their intellectual integrity, their honesty, this is the way they view the case, may not be the popular ruling. But here, at this point, let me just tell everybody, if you have a question, please put it in the Q&A, and I will ask the question for you to Professor Dolan. While we're waiting to see if there's any questions, what about the public fisc component? You talked about the pro-veteran canon, but you also referenced the public fisc. And I can imagine that judges, where there's not an express direction from Congress, might be concerned about the significant impacts on the public fisc. Is there a public fisc canon that they try to protect public expenditures where it's not clearly indicated?
I don't think there's an explicit canon. I think, you know, to the extent that there is a kind of a public fisc canon, I think it would be sort of a subset of the, you know, as Justice Scalia once famously put it, Congress does not tend to hide elephants in mouth holes. Sure. So if, for example, if one interpretation would lead to some absolutely unimagined expenditures of significant amount of money, which, of course, that's also a debate. What's significant? As you know, the DC joke goes, $500 million here and $500 million there, and pretty soon we're talking about real money. So what the question is, what's significant? So I think if court were to face with a situation where one interpretation leads to some really significant federal outlays that does not seem to have been considered by Congress, and the other interpretation does not, they might at least pause, not necessarily because they're themselves are concerned by public fisc, but because one would think that if there are significant expenditures, Congress would probably consider them, debate them, have them scored by CBO, you know, potentially have some other offsetting spending cuts or offsetting tax increases or whatever else before, you know, spending trillions of dollars. So I think it's a subset of, Congress does not hide elephants in mouse holes, but I don't think court as a separate matter is, or I don't think it necessarily should be concerned whether a particular program is going to be too expensive. I think that's a question is for Congress. Congress can decide whether we want to spend money on veterans or children or neither or both, or, you know, prisons or education or whatever else. And the court is simply has to interpret congressional handiwork.
Well, so now Dering has been interpreted here. It's a Supreme Court case. It caused a 5-4 split. If you're Congress in the future legislating in this area, how would you respond to this decision?
Maybe you don't respond. Maybe that's actually what Congress meant, because like I said, and I think we're in agreement on this. This may be a decision that both Republicans and Democrats like, both because for political reasons that everybody wants to go home and say, you know, I was for veterans, and nobody wants to go sit home and say, like, I cut money for the veterans. Right. I made it harder to enroll in or to serve in reserve. So for political reasons, but I think they may also like it for national security reasons. Because if Justice Gorsuch is right that serving even in the, in the background frees up other people to serve in the foreground and thus making our military stronger, then the decision also bolsters our, the law as interpreted by the court does bolster our national security. So Congress may not want to necessarily change interpretation of this statute, but in the future, in other situations, if Congress really wanted to be clear, they could say, and actually the majority does point out that in other situations, Congress does say during and in relation to, right? Or during and in substantial relation to, or while doing these specific factors or specific activities. So if Congress really wants to limit the word during to not merely a time component, but also to time and relational component, all you have to do is say so. And it's not hard. And so ultimately what the court is doing is it's holding Congress to its responsibility to write statutes as clearly as possible so that it can work its will. The court is not working its will here. They simply say, this is what Congress meant to the best of our lights. And if Congress wants to mean something else, they can always change the statute.
So let me go a little bit different direction before we conclude. So, the determination of what during means here, I could see, the Merit Systems Protection Board had spoken on that. You could imagine the federal government having a view of that, the executive branch. So does the elimination of Chevron deference and, Loper-Bright, does that change this at all? In maybe 3 or 4 years ago, would it have been more likely that the court would have deferred to the executive branch's interpretation of what during meant here?
They may have if there was a specific rule. And I haven't really delved into it, whether Mr. Feliciano was denied differential pay because of existence of a specific rule. So, even under Chevron, generally the courts were much more skeptical about deferring to the executive to a position taken in litigation, right? So it had to be, they usually would defer to positions taken pre-litigation through traditional notice and comment or other kind of regular order interpretation. So it may not have come out any different under Chevron if there was not an explicit rule or some sort of prior consideration prior to litigation. But certainly even if there was, obviously, Loper-Bright changes the calculus as to how the court approaches it.
Understood. I also wondered whether maybe this is part, and I'm not saying this is a major question or something like that, but maybe this ties a little bit into the court's desire to have Congress speak more specifically when it's making decisions. And so, in this particular case, they interpreted during probably it's more common definition, which is temporal. And the federal FISC bears the consequences, but they're protecting federal employees, I guess. Any final thoughts on the decision before we conclude?
I think I completely agree. I think, some of our statutes are written in a frustratingly convoluted fashion. And, I don't want to be too hard on Congress because in part, it's not as necessarily as if Congress sat down and wrote the entire U.S. code in one sitting. where everything makes sense and all the cross-references make sense. You know, they were written over, I think when was the big revision, about a century ago, maybe a little bit less. So, and things get added and things get subtracted, and sometimes the cross-references are not done perfectly. And, you know, Congress is busy and things happen. And so I don't want to be too hard on Congress, but at the end of the day, you know, we, the citizens, have to live under the laws that Congress enacts, and we should be able to understand what they mean. And so I think the court is gently nudging Congress to try to be a bit more clear in, especially if they want to be more restrictive in the way the laws are read. Otherwise, the court said that, I think court's position is like, we are going to read the law in the most kind of, in a way that makes the most sense. And yeah, and sometimes, somebody's ox is going to get gored and you're going to hear from your constituents. And some of you may get voted out of office. Maybe not because of this bill, because again, I think everybody's going to like giving more money to the veterans. But, you know, if you, if the law is unclear, somebody's ox is going to get gored, and hopefully the political process will work itself to fix those problems. But if you don't want those problems to begin with, then try to do a better job writing things more clearly. Not always possible, but more clarity is generally better. And it's better not just to make judges' lives easier. Ultimately, they're better for liberty. Because if we as the citizens know what the law expects of us and what we can expect, what kind of benefits or detriments we can expect from a particular action that we take, we are then more free to decide whether or not to take a particular action. I think that is ultimately the overriding blessing of textualism, that it does let people know with more clarity as to what really the law expects of them.
Extremely well said. I couldn't agree more. Thank you, Professor Dolan. It's been a real pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you for this 45 minutes. And thanks again to the Federalist Society for having both of us on.
Thanks to the Federalist Society, Kayla.
I'll echo those thanks and move to wrap it out. Professor Dolan, Mr. Lean, thank you so much for taking the section of your days and breaking down this case and sharing your expertise and insight. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at PedSocForums@PedSoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.